It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new report breaks down the costs of health insurance in different regions of Wisconsin and what people in different parts of the state get for their insurance spending.
First, the UW-Madison often ends up on a top 10 list that administrators would rather avoid as one of the top party schools in the nation.
And digging deeper into some lists, other Wisconsin campuses do pop up. I've seen UW-La Crosse and UW-Whitewater making lists of party schools, for example.
Our next guest digs into what it means to be a party school and how alcohol culture affects students, campuses, and the communities they live in.
Karen Weiss joins us now. She's a professor of sociology at West Virginia University, another party campus on many lists. Her new book is Party School: Crime, Campus, and Community. Karen, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, how do you define a party school?
Well, actually, the definition I use in the book is very consistent with how the Princeton Review defines theirs. I mean, there's several lists, but the Princeton Review's criteria, I think, is probably the best to use. So it looks at the amount of alcohol students claim to drink, whether or not they smoke marijuana, their commitment to the Greek life. And then, so those are high scores, and then they compare those to the scores of how frequently the students say they study. And so you have sort of a calculation of high scores on the party factors and a low score on the study, and you get your party schools. That's how Princeton Review does it, and basically it's based on student self-identification with the idea of partying, because it's a voluntary survey. So, you know, when schools like Madison or you know, all of the others that are consistently on the list keep coming up, it's because students are very proud to be on those lists, and it almost becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's very hard to get off those lists once a school makes it on there.
You came to work at a party school after working at commuter campuses. What struck you about the party culture, the alcohol culture, when you first moved there?
You know, it's interesting because a lot of it is hidden. When you live in a college town, a lot of what the students do, it's almost a secret. It's a secretive life that they have outside of, you know, what I saw in the classrooms. It was the stories I began to hear that became very striking. And so it's really why I began to collect data and to write the book, because I was astounded by these crazy stories that they were telling me. And I thought, to be honest, at first I thought they were making it up.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't believe that this much was going on. But it really is, it's not secretive by any stretch of the imagination, but I don't think that most people see it firsthand.
Well, it's a different world, you write, between daytime and nighttime, or fill in with nighttime there, maybe game day.
Yes, that's that and some other holiday occasions. You can have the party life come out during the daylight hours, but usually it's a nighttime activity for sure.
So what were some of the stories you were hearing that caught your attention and made you want to study this more?
Well, I mean, first it was just the quantities. It seemed out of, you know, it's been many years since I've been an undergrad, but it just seemed like I couldn't believe that they could drink as much as they claimed to drink and still come to class and sort of be coherent. And it was the amount. And there's students at a lot of these types of schools that literally go out six nights a week, and people find that incredibly hard to believe, but it really happens. So you wonder how they really are able to fit in, squeeze in their academics, and what ends up happening is a lot of them don't. And, you know, and so they really only make it through their freshman year, and we lose a lot of them. But, I mean, the other stories were some of the injuries. I had a student once walk into one of my classes with a broken leg and proceeded to tell me their whole story. So, you know, even with all of these bad consequences, they keep a good humor about it. They actually, many students really find it very entertaining and humorous, and so a lot of what intrigued me wasn't necessarily that all of these crazy things were happening, but it was how normal it seemed to them.
Not even that, but even a badge of honor, it almost seems like, in some cases.
Yeah, yes, exactly. If you survived the craziest of the crazy parties, yeah, you have a lot to talk about the next couple of weeks.
Is everyone doing it, or does everyone think everyone else is doing it, so it seems natural and they maybe strive to fit in?
Well, I absolutely think a lot of students strive to fit in, because in a lot of these areas, a lot of these schools, there really is very little else to do other than to drink. And that's, I think, the saddest reality, is that students themselves will tell me if they don't party, if they don't like alcohol, if they don't want to, you know, hang out at these bars or these parties, they really feel marginalized, and there's not that much they can do. But not everybody, of course, is partying to these extremes. A lot of students are very responsible when they drink, and they know when they've had enough. So, you know, I break down the percentages in the book, and from how I identified the different types of partiers, about half of them are what I would call almost irresponsible, but only 14% are truly irresponsible and are really causing the bulk of the problems, I mean, not only for themselves, but really for the community.
And that's where I wanted to go next. What about the people who live in these communities and have to deal with that maybe 14% of completely irresponsible people? What kind of mayhem is out there for people who live there?
It's not good. I mean, I think it was one of the, because, again, I'm not actually impacted. I've never been impacted by this, and I think a lot of people aren't directly impacted unless you live in sort of what I call the hot spots of these communities, which is really right sort of on the parameters of where most of the students live, or where all of the bars are. So almost every college town I know of, and I assume Madison has this too, because I've read up a lot on Madison specifically, and there's always a zone, a student bar zone. And so anybody who lives within those areas, I think, at the worst of sort of these ripple effects of the students as they're leaving the bars or as they're going to parties, when these students get wasted, they seem to lose all sense of, I don't know, empathy for their neighbors or just a common sense. They lose common sense, and they no longer have any respect for themselves or other people. And it really is astounding because, you know, during the day they're very nice people, but something happens when they get involved, you know, at nighttime with this party subculture, and the rules just change dramatically.
I've seen a presentation by police here in Madison explaining where a lot of the tax dollars go, and a chart showing the downtown area that you're talking mm-hmm. about, and the peak in police calls at 2 a.m. bar time, mm-hmm. enormous, just a huge, again, it's like it's a nice place when we're all sober, but it goes nuts around bar time.
Yeah. So as I say, it's hard to explain because they're really, you know, as I said, the stories that are in the book, and I don't even need necessarily the stories in the book. If you walk down there on a Sunday morning, it's crazy. Or after games, even, you know, in most of the town, where just broken beer bottles, or just the glass alone, the debris, the vandalism. So there's litter, the vandalism. I mean, a lot of residents in some of those neighborhoods will complain about just kids sort of vomiting, you know, on their front lawns and walks, and just, you know, whatever remnants of intoxication you can see are usually in these areas. So it does become pretty bad, and I have some excerpts in the book from residents that live in those neighborhoods who are raising kids mm-hmm. and are, like, you know, afraid to let their kids go out at certain times. And so it's, you know, I make a reference to them feeling like hostages. And, you know, to some degree it really has become that much of a problem in some of these communities within the town where, you know, sort of the party zones.
We've got a caller on the line, Michael in Milwaukee. Michael, hi, you're on the air.
Hello, how's it going?
Good. What's your story or question?
Well, it's actually more of an observation, I would guess, but I would like to think that I'm a pretty avid drinker in Milwaukee. I, almost the same as you guys were saying in Madison, I'll go out maybe 6 days a week. But the difference between that I find being a party school in Madison and, let's say, UWM, or I live on the east side near UWM, although I do not attend. In Madison, whenever people decide they're going out, they'll instead drink at home for multiple hours before they even go to the bars. While in Milwaukee, we will, or from my experience at least, we will go to the bars, have a couple beers, maybe a shot, but we never really let it get out of hand. And when you're going out six nights a week, it's generally you're going to the same place with the same people, so you do develop a group. While in Madison, you'll start off with a house party, and then it'll turn into a bigger thing, and then that whole group will go to a bar, and they'll get there remarkably late, from my experience. So by the time they actually leave the bar, they're incredibly intoxicated, and I think that's where a lot of the vandalism and whatnot comes from.
Great. Thanks for the call, Michael, and sharing your experience in Madison and Milwaukee. Is that an experience you see often, Karen?
Well, it's actually interesting that, first of all, so he does go out six, so I don't know how somebody can go out six nights a week, but more power to anybody who could. What he's describing, the pre-gaming, this idea that there's sort of levels of drinking where it starts, you know, in somebody's home and they do some drinking there and then it goes someplace else and they drink there. And then eventually, if they can get into bars, they'll go to the bars as the final. But I do think people have told me this a lot. Some of the students in the book say that when they turn 21 and they can finally go into a bar and drink legally, because we know a lot of students drink illegally in bars as well, but when they can do that, they do tend to be more responsible.
We're talking to sociologist Karen Weiss of West Virginia University. Her new book is Party School. She looks at party and alcohol culture on college campuses.
And we want to hear from you. Are you a college student? And what do you see on your campus when it comes to parties and alcohol? Do you live in one of the many college towns in Wisconsin? And how do you see that party culture playing out in your own life? If you work on a campus, what kind of efforts do you see to get drinking and partying under control? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We pick up our conversation now with Karen Weiss about her new book, Party School. It talks about alcohol and party culture on American campuses and how they affect students and communities.
You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234 or send us an email, talk@wpr.org. We'll go back to your calls now. We have Eric with us in Kenosha. Eric, hi.
Yes, hello. I have, you still hear me?
Yep, go for it.
Oh, okay, good. I wanted to comment because I was one of those wild and rowdy students back at UW-Madison in the 80s when the drinking age was still 18. But shortly thereafter, it changed to, I believe it was 19 and then 21 eventually. And the climate of that particular campus changed dramatically from 1 year to the next. The places you could go, the kinds of, unbelievable, bar and drink specials you would find, and the prevalence of the alcohol in the dorms. And I'm curious if your guest has any comments on how changes in the drinking age affect these kind of reputations, because my experience with Madison today is that it's still not nearly, as wild as it once was, which is probably a good thing.
Interesting. Thanks for the call, Eric. Your thoughts, Karen, on drinking age and party culture?
Was he implying that it got worse with the age increasing to 21 or better?
Sounded like worse and then better, if I made him out right. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought, because at first I thought he was, because there's a lot of people who make the argument that part of the problems we're seeing now, not only on college campuses, but in high schools, is due to the, maybe it wouldn't affect high school because they're not 18 yet, but when we change the drinking age nationally to 21 in the 80s, it really caused unintended consequences of these young people between 18 and 20 doing this pre-gaming, loading up on alcohol before they went out because they knew they couldn't buy it legally, and so it sort of created these binging problems that we're seeing. I mean, that's the argument, and a lot of college administrators really agree with that. And a while back, and I don't know what's happened with the initiative, but a lot of college presidents got together under what was called an amnestist initiative, mm-hmm. and wanted to try and convince lawmakers to change the age again, the drinking age, down to 18. So I think that actually a lot of people believe that that would actually alleviate some of these problems, is just changing the drinking age again.
We'll go back to the phones now. We have Lorenzo with us in Milwaukee. Lorenzo, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to talk about what it was like to be a student at UW-Madison. I graduated in 2008, and I lived in one of the hot spots on Langdon, which is a street that houses all the fraternities, and it's also probably right next to the student bar zone that she kind of defined. I just wanted to share that, you know, being a student of color on campus became extremely difficult after 2 a.m. Because you would see the ugliest side of the student faces. So during the day, as you said, everyone was pretty nice, pretty cordial, but in the evening, that's when you really got really aggressive language, which often bordered on violence. And I think if you go and you take a poll of students of color at UW-Madison, they might find that it is a really unsafe environment in the evening for people. Of course, you know, students of color and everyone is engaging in their partying, but I think after a couple of months, you'll find that freshmen are learning a lesson that comes from experience, and that lesson is that you should not try to engage in the mainstream culture's partying unless you subject yourself to name-calling, potentially violent situations. I don't know if your book covers that. Do you cover that in your book?
Lorenzo, thanks for the call. Karen?
Actually, that's really horrible to hear, and actually there's not that much of the racial tensions in the book, because the population I used didn't have that much of a racial diversity. But I have a new study that we are actually capturing harassment that includes the racial problems as well as sexual harassment. And he's absolutely right. When people get wasted, whatever, you know, senses, you know, the whole you know, being polite to people and just treating people fairly and equally just seems to shift. And so you've got a lot of even the students in my book complain a lot about verbal harassment of all sorts. And so I certainly can see that race would be a part of that. I mean, at my school, the bigger problem is harassment based on sexual orientation.
Thanks for the call, Lorenzo. We'll go to Mark in Madison now. Mark, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, first of all, I want to say I had a very positive collegiate experience. A big part of that was the social life. Now, I definitely, my junior and senior year, could be considered one of the guys who was out six nights a week, not a problem. And for me, in the short term, that had a big effect. I was an athlete that had suffered an injury, and it kind of changed my whole social prerogative. But I put on weight. I definitely drank more than I ever had in my entire life. The question's going to be, is this a matter of kids being kids or students being students, or is it having a prolonged effect once they've graduated? Since I've graduated, I graduated in 2008. You know, I've lost all the weight. I'm much healthier, and I hardly drink. But it wasn't because I overdrank in college or anything else. It was more of a life decision.
Gotcha. Thanks for the call, Mark. So, Karen, are we seeing long-term impacts on students of drinking culture?
No, and actually, that's exactly why the subculture has sustained. He is absolutely right, and most everybody makes it out fine. You know, a lot of times the media will capture the rare tragedies that happen, and there are, you know, tragedies every now and again that occur. But most of what happens are, you know, what the students themselves would consider minor. I call them collateral damage. You know, yeah, they have an injury here and there. They get a lot of hangovers. They black out, all of these issues. But they end up getting their degrees, and most of them go on fine. And it actually works really well because they have great memories of the school. It's great for alumni, you know, alumni who give back to the school, and they come to all the tailgates. And so it actually works out pretty well, and it's really the primary reason why even when schools try and make some changes, they really can't, because most people do have pretty positive memories of their partying years.
Just briefly, is there a way to change that culture in our last minute?
Well, I think there may be, but what it would really take is a huge collaborative effort on the parts of universities, on the parts of the community leaders, of the police, of students themselves have to be a part of this, you know, the student organizations. I mean, it really has to be a collaborative effort, because otherwise I just don't think, it's just such a strong subculture at this point with so much tradition involved that it's really hard to change tradition at this point.
Karen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
That was Karen Weiss, sociologist at West Virginia University. Her new book is Party School, Crime, Campus, and Community.
Coming up, a look at health insurance in Wisconsin. A new report breaks down the cost for people in different parts of the state and compares the quality of the plans people are getting. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
A new report out today from Citizen Action of Wisconsin details variations in health care costs around the state.
While costs are fairly high everywhere, the report shows that some regions of the state are paying thousands of dollars more for health insurance than others. But why?
Joining us now to get a handle on that question is Robert Craig, Executive Director of Citizen Action of Wisconsin. Robert, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, there seem to be some pretty significant regional differences in the cost of health care in Wisconsin. How typical is that?
Well, we've been doing this report for 8 years, and we found very large variations in the large group market, that is, insurance bought by medium and large companies, and they're 23% this year between the highest cost area, which is southeast Wisconsin, and the lowest cost, which is Madison. This year, we were able to add, because of the new health insurance marketplaces, both in small business insurance and also insurance people buying their own, and we found the variations even larger there, up to 55% between the high-cost area and the low-cost areas of the state. So where you live has a huge impact on just how high your health insurance premiums are going to be.
Now, why would that be?
Well, we've been looking at this for a number of years, and we've always thought it had most to do with the various cost of hospitals and providers in different regions of the state and whether they had how competitive they were with each other. But we found this year differences between the types of insurance in the same regions, which tells us that there may also be market distortions in the insurance market. So it may also have to do with insurance and how much profit there is and overhead there is per region, or how much people are being charged, maybe being overcharged in some regions compared to others. But it's both underlying medical costs and health insurance itself and how it's sold and what the profit margin is.
So in general, would you say that paying more means that we get better coverage?
We have not found that this year or previous years. In fact, there's good quality data for large employers, and it finds that the highest cost area, southeast Wisconsin, has the lowest quality insurance, and some of the lowest cost areas, such as Madison, have the highest quality insurance. There are other high cost areas like northwest Wisconsin, Eau Claire and La Crosse, that both have high cost and high quality. So we didn't find any direct correlation. In fact, some of the most expensive insurance is the worst insurance.
Now, that's a pretty remarkable finding. Some of the most expensive insurance is the worst insurance. So what is happening to cause a result like that?
Well, a big variable is who sells the insurance. We found that the for-profit national companies like United Healthcare, Humana, have lower quality insurance, where the in-state kind of provider-driven local companies, your group health cooperatives in Madison, for example, have the highest quality insurance. And so it's partly a matter of that. But this also relates to a lot of healthcare research that shows that cost and quality are not well connected at all. In fact, we know from a lot of national research that often the highest cost is lower quality. And so the real issue here is to get to value, to get as good a cost as possible for high quality insurance and coverage. And we have a long way to go in Wisconsin and nationally to do that.
And I'm assuming that people don't know that. They're not saying, I'm going to buy a plan that costs me a lot more, but it's going to give me less. So how is this happening that people are ending up with plans like these?
Well, it's a lack of transparency in part. It's also part of a lack of regional choice, but we have a better sense, say, in buying an automobile, what a higher or lower quality is, at least in terms of what people are willing to pay for, right? In health insurance, that's not been the case. And I think as we go to these competitive marketplaces under the Affordable Care Act, people will be able to compare apples to apples much better. And so there should be, if we do this right, more competition. But if you're in Southeast Wisconsin, for example, you have little choice up until now other than to choose a for-profit national health insurance company, which is high cost and low quality.
Well, you brought up the Affordable Care Act. Any sense so far about how that's going to be affecting things?
Well, we have first-year data, so we don't know how the inflation rate will go. We know, based on previously, that there's been a tripling of health insurance rates in Wisconsin. And so I think we think it's going to be depend upon how it's implemented, and that's going to differ between states. A state like Minnesota is trying to use all the tools of the Affordable Care Act. Wisconsin's government has not been inclined to do so. It's been very opposed to the law. But I would say that it provides more leverage, more mechanisms to try to take on costs, but it doesn't do so automatically. It depends on how you implement it and how you use it in each state.
Now let's talk for a moment about large group health insurance plans. Now it seems like they've more than doubled since 2000, according to your findings. What accounts for that? Is it just inflation?
We had a huge burst of health insurance hyperinflation starting in the year 2000. And it's moderated a little bit the last couple of years. In fact, we're at a 50-year low right now as far as hyperinflation and insurance. It's still higher than the cost of living is in terms of inflation. But we think that this system has been broken. This great inflation has occurred at the same time that plans have been hollowed out and have had less and less value and have shifted more and more costs onto individual consumers and patients. And so this is partly why we got healthcare reform in the first place. A lot of people, even in the healthcare industry, realized the pace of hyperinflation wasn't sustainable. And the one thing we have on the table now that could possibly come to terms with it, or at least moderate it, is the Affordable Care Act. But we're stuck in a debate about whether we'll keep that or not, rather than moving into the next question after coverage, which is cost.
Now, earlier you mentioned that one thing that could be responsible for getting, you know, an inferior plan that costs more is distortions in the market. What exactly does that mean?
Well, insurance companies, you would think it would, if it was a perfect market, then the rate would reflect what the underlying cost of medical care was. So the underlying cost of medical care in Green Bay ought to be the same no matter what type of insurance it is. It's the same hospitals, et cetera. And that doesn't seem to be the case, which would suggest that some people are getting much less value than others in terms of what the rate is versus what the underlying medical costs are. We've seen the same thing in comparing to Wisconsin to Minnesota, where the underlying medical costs are very similar, but the insurance rates are much higher in Wisconsin than Minnesota. And so that is the situation. Medical costs are a huge issue that we need to get our hands around, but there seem to also be distortions in the insurance market where some people are paying much more than others when medical costs in the area are similar.
Now, one thing we hear a lot about is that the boomer generation is huge and it's aging and requiring a lot of health care. Is that something that's having any sort of play here?
Well, if you have an older population, it does need more medical care. That's absolutely true. But the system that has had the least inflation overall is Medicare, which, of course, is the oldest population. It's seniors. And if you have higher utilization groups, the quality becomes even more important. In other words, having good screenings, having chronic disease management where you work with people who have chronic diseases to make sure they don't get sicker and don't end up in life-threatening situations that are costly to address. And so, in fact, the older the population is, the more important it is that be high-quality coverage, yet invest in prevention, chronic disease management, and other things that keep people healthier and intervene earlier in the process before they're very sick and costlier to medicate or to treat.
Now, what is the takeaway here as you see it, both for healthcare consumers and for policymakers?
What we found, two findings we made in this report is, one, it looks like Madison rates are lower because they have, in the large group market, because of all the state employees who are in a competitive bidding process. That's how the state employee plan works. It would suggest we should grow the new state marketplaces to have more participants so there's more market power to bargain with insurance companies and medical providers. The second is, with these distortions, we really, in the insurance market, we really should look at rate reviews. States that have had robust rate reviews review where they make insurance companies justify their rates and block rates that are excessive, aren't based on real data and facts, have lowered rates. And Wisconsin is not doing that and could. So I think it really, that these are examples of where we need to use all the tools available to address this problem, because it's a huge problem for business competitiveness and just for individuals to be able to afford insurance, which is a necessity in the 21st century. So we just need to work on this together as a major public policy issue going forward and not just get caught in this perpetual loop around the Affordable Care Act that we've been having for the last 4 years.
Robert, thank you so much for being with us today.
Pleasure to join you. Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking to Robert Craig, Executive Director of Citizen Action of Wisconsin.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. About 12 years ago, the Northern Door Children's Center in Sister Bay adopted a new approach to early childhood education called looping.
Here to explain what looping is and what it does for young kids is Karen Corkin. She's Community Relations Coordinator for the Northern Door Children's Center. Karen, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So it sounds like some crazy tricycle stunt. I'm guessing it's not quite that fun, but what exactly is looping?
Well, looping is a process in which children, a group of young children, come together. Usually we start a group about 6 weeks old, because we do have quite a few children that come to us that young. They join either one or two teachers, depending on the number of children in the classroom, and those children and those teachers stay together for 3 years. So instead of, which is what's more typical in early childhood education, children changing classrooms and changing teachers with every developmental milestone, instead, the group stays together. So it's the same peers, the same teachers, and they change classrooms, but they do it together.
What are the benefits? Why make this change?
Well, what happens is when a child has to make a major change, like giving up somebody who's a significant adult in their life, a teacher that they've had for, you know, 6 months to a year, when they have to make that change and give that person up and move to and have to make new connections, it's very stressful. The children actually do go through a grieving process, and that will slow down the learning process. Also, what slows it down is the teachers then have to learn the children, you know, new children all over again, and then they're also having to adjust to new peers. All of that slows down that process because they're losing that learning time. Where for us, with the looping process, when our children change classrooms, they do it with their same peers that they've been with since they were infants, with the same teacher who has known them for their whole life, and for them, a new classroom is just new activities, new toys, you know, a lot of fun to go with their educational experience. So the stress that comes with that constant changing is removed in the looping process.
What kind of reactions have you seen from kids over the long term of doing this?
Well, it's interesting. Our first group has actually started the sixth grade this year, and as each group has gone along, those connections the children have made with each other have stayed very, very strong. They have those connections, and the connections that their families have with the teachers and with the other families continues to be very strong. I mean, we are a small community up here, but I think that's true of any program that chooses to do a looping program. They make those very strong connections, and it's just very healthy for them in their terms of their social emotional development, and then the families as well. There's just not the stress of having to adjust to a new person who is their child's teacher constantly. The parents and the teachers are able to form very, very strong partnerships that work for the benefit of the children.
And, yeah, do you see a better sense of communication there, teacher and parent and kid to teacher, for that matter?
Absolutely. Because you begin to know these children, you know, it's in so many ways as though they're your own, because you're with them so much. I actually did a loop of children myself, and that I still have the connections to them. They're all going into they just went into the fourth grade this year, and the connection that you have is so strong with that family, you just don't lose that. It's, in a lot of ways, the children become almost like siblings, and it just really, really makes a huge difference in how the brain grows. It's very positive. It's a very positive effect on children's brain growth.
For the teachers, you and the others, is there some trepidation going in? It's a very different sort of thing. When you start this class, you know you're in with them for 3 years.
Absolutely. And I'll have to say that's one of the things that's really important for any early childhood center or school that's going to try, you know, getting the looping process going is you have to have teacher buy-in because, you know, teachers in the early childhood education setting are very much like teachers in the elementary and middle and high school, that graded school where you're used to teaching a particular thing. What happens with looping then is that you have to be able to plan the educational experiences for children all the way through. So you're constantly learning and growing along with the children. And so there was, yeah, definitely some trepidation for some of our teachers at first. But, you know, after a few years, really no one could remember what it was like before because everyone had really begun to see the incredible benefits that we were seeing with the children in terms of their learning, in terms of their socialization, you know, all of their development was so enhanced, and we could really see the difference.
But I wonder, eventually they're going to get to a school level where they're switching classes each year or then eventually switching classes each hour, going from math to science or what have you. Isn't there some benefit to experiencing the change early on, seeing different styles, different types of people up in front of them teaching?
Definitely, and that's why we did some experimenting with it, and we did try a five-year loop where the same teacher stayed with children for 5 years, but we did find that those first 3 years are the most critical in terms of children's development, and so we've kept the loop to the first three years. Once they've completed the first 3 years, one of the looping teachers will make the transition with them into preschool to a new teacher, help them get settled in, and then that teacher goes back and starts a new loop. So now the children have, you know, an entirely new teacher. And because they have those strong foundations and the strong skills that they've gotten in those first 3 years, they're very, very comfortable, you know, starting with a new teacher because they're, you know, very confident. And then when they've completed their preschool experience and we have a four-year-old kindergarten program, they move to the next teacher. So they do have that opportunity to experience changing teachers. But it's those first 3 years that are just so critical in terms of children's development, and those strong attachments really, really make a difference.
And in terms of development, I suppose somebody 3 years old and younger, very different developmentally than somebody when they hit elementary school age.
Absolutely, because, you know, we're looking at so many different pieces of the children's development. As early childhood educators, we're focused on all aspects of the development. So, you know, in the beginning with young infants, you know, there is quite a bit of you know, care that is required and, you know, changing diapers and feeding and all of those things. But each of those things gives you an opportunity. We call them teachable moments, great opportunities for, you know, doing learning activities with children. So, you know, even those first 3 years, just, you know, a lot of learning going on.
I don't know if this is the case this early on, but sometimes you hear of or experience in school at some point a bad match between a teacher and a student. Mm-hmm. What happens if you're stuck there for 3 years in a bad match, or maybe between the teacher and the parent at that age?
Well, you know, it's interesting because we kind of look at the relationship between the teacher, the parent, you know, or the family and the children. In some ways, it's almost like a marriage. You make a commitment to make it work. And so if there's issues, we really, really work through them. And frankly, we haven't had that much of a problem because everybody is clear at the very beginning that we're all here for the children. We're here for the very best interests of what is good and best practice for the children. And so, you know, that's been a very rare occurrence, but it's very much like a marriage. You are committed to it and you make it work for those 3 years.
You're doing this there in Sister Bay. I understand that this is done elsewhere. Do you have a sense of how widespread this is, or is looping something that's really new and not a lot of people are jumping on it yet?
I don't think it's particularly new in terms of elementary school, and I know if anyone's familiar with Waldorf education, now that's a particular type of educational system where a group of children teachers will often stay together for 8 to 9 years. But it's not quite as widespread as I think it should be in early childhood education because, to be honest with you, it's not an easy process. It's very easy just to move children from class to class. But we talk a lot here at the Children's Center about the integrity of the loop. We hang on to the integrity of the loop. We keep those children together and making the change, deciding when, you know, they're going to make a move to another classroom and, you know, all of those things. It's a little complicated, and I know we actually did a presentation about looping at the National Association for the Education of Young Children, their national conference several years ago. And that was the big question everybody kept saying is, you know, how do we make this work? And it's not easy, but it is definitely what is best for children.
Yeah,
there's no question.
When you introduce this idea to somebody in the industry, in the profession, who hasn't tried it, do you get a lot of quizzical looks and skepticism?
I think everyone would probably agree who's read the research on the continuity of the, you know, the educational experience for young children, because that's what looping is. It's about that continuity of education. I think they would all agree that it's definitely best for children. I just think, you know, you have to be willing to make that commitment, and not everybody is. But it's just a commitment to knowing what is very, very best for children and being willing to do that. So that was one of the reasons I wanted to have an opportunity to speak about looping, because it's worth it. It is definite for any early childhood facility or organization. It is absolutely worth doing.
So you'd say it's worth that initial upfront work and getting things right? And any daycare out there, or any early education center, you'd say give it a shot?
Absolutely. And one of the things that I think is really, really helpful is for families, you know, parents to understand the importance of this and for them to ask for it. Parents should advocate for their children's school or care providers to do this, because it's definitely what's best for them as a family and for their children.
Karen, thanks so much for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me on.
That's Karen Corkin. She's Community Relations Coordinator for the Northern Door Children's Center up in Sister Bay.